From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today on Fresh Air, we conclude our series on young people and the epidemic of violence in America. Eric Davis grew up in a Chicago housing project and belonged to a gang. Now he's an undercover cop who patrols Chicago housing projects. There's a lot of distrust of cops in the projects, but Davis has won the respect of a lot of young people. In fact, some of them are fans of his group, the Slick Boys, a rap group he started with two other undercover cops. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new romantic comedy, The Brothers McMullen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we conclude our series on young people and the epidemic of violence in American cities. Eric Davis is an undercover cop in the housing projects of Chicago. He's no outsider there. He grew up in the Cabrini-Green housing project. The projects are now ruled by gangs. Shootouts are commonplace. Earlier this year in one of the projects, two kids, one age 10, the other 11, threw a 5-year-old boy out the window to his death. My guest Eric Davis is known by his nickname, 21. He's even better known as one of the Slick Boys. The Slick Boys are a rap group made up of Davis and two other undercover cops who patrol the Chicago housing projects.
Motivation is our single object. We come from the streets, raised in the projects. Ghetto land was a type of sin. I live now, die, fuck a brain.
Rapping undercover cops may sound like a gimmick, but it's more than that for the Slick Boys. They've caught on. Their videos have been played on MTV and Video Jukebox. The Slick Boys are the basis of the Fox TV series New York Undercover. They've toured the country, rapping and talking to kids about the consequences of violence. Apparently, they're heroes in the neighborhood, even to many kids who distrust cops. Last February, I asked Eric Davis how the Cabrini-Green housing projects had changed since the time he grew up there.
It's become an environment that almost has turned hopeless. And by that I mean, when I grew up, it was a place where poor people got on their feet to get an opportunity to move on to the next level. And that's what plenty families did, and that's what my family did. We raised ourselves up from Cabrini and moved on to the next level. Now with the problem of unemployment and the problem of drugs and gang violence, it's very difficult to get over those obstacles to move on to the next level.
I was, you know, reading Newsweek, which gives these statistics, which are really alarming. In Chicago last year, 231 children under the age of 17 were arrested on murder charges, and 156 were murdered. A recent study of 203 high school students in the Southside Police District found that 45% of the students have seen someone killed, 6% have been shot themselves, 8% have been stabbed, 7% raped, and nearly half of the students have been shot at. Does this reflect what you see on your beat?
It reflects exactly a lot of the things I see, but not just in Chicago. We go all over the country with our program, and we're seeing it in Decatur, Georgia. We're seeing it in Casper, Wyoming. We're seeing it in New York City. This is a phenom that we have to change. And it's not up to our children to change the behavior that they're seeing. It's up to us as adults to step in and try to teach these young people how to change and monitor their behaviors by first monitoring our own behaviors.
The kids that you see, would you say that a lot of them live in fear now, or that they've become so hardened they're not fearful?
Well, I think it's kind of a situation where both of those things are probably apparent at once. I think they're so afraid that they feel they have to be hard. On numerous occasions, we stop kids with guns, and, you know, they'll tell you, look, 21, I'd rather you catch me with it than them catch me without it. And if you see me tomorrow, I'm going to have a gun again, because the police can't protect me 24 hours a day. My mother can't protect me, so I have to protect myself. So somewhere along the line, our children have this misconception that guns protect them. And I'd like to take kids from all over the country and show them that there are plenty of people that I find shot dead, stabbed dead, choked dead, with a gun in their waistband. Guns don't protect, guns only kill. And what protects you is getting knowledgeable, getting yourself in a situation that you don't have to be around things that may cause a dangerous situation to occur, which is gangs, drugs. Get more employment opportunities in poor communities so now we don't have those that are frustrated and angry hanging out all day. I think there are a lot of methods we could use to deter our young people from going the way of violence.
What do you do when you run into a teenager or someone even younger with a gun? When you know the kid and you think they're a good kid and you know that they have the gun thinking that it's going to protect them, do you take the gun away from them? Do you arrest them because they're carrying a gun, or do you just let it go because you think they're a good kid and you understand their need for self-protection?
Well, the first thing we do is we arrest them for having the gun.
You do?
Because, oh, no doubt. The first thing young people have to realize is that there are consequences. And the consequences you just faced were you got locked up for having this gun. And I'd rather the young people face that consequence than the consequence of using it. And what we usually say to our young people, Terry, is this: one shot, two drop. What happens is you shoot that one guy and he dies. That's a given. But now you're in the penitentiary for 50 years. You're living a 50-year death. So if you don't have it, you don't even have to take that chance. If you get yourself involved in programs, if you're not hanging on the street, if you're not dealing with confrontation where you think it has to come to an end, a permanent end, and you're learning conflict resolution and learning how to deal with your situations, then you won't have to worry about that, and you wouldn't have to worry about carrying a gun.
When you're on patrol, knowing how many young people carry guns now, how does that shape how you treat young people, how you react to them when you see them, knowing that they might have a deadly weapon on them?
Well, when I first approach them, I have to approach them with the thought of, I have to guard my life, and I have to guard their life. So the first thing I have to do, where maybe 10 years ago you could say, hey, how are you guys doing? How was school today? The first thing you're saying is, hey, take your hands out of your pockets. Hey, take that mask down off your face. Let me see your hands. And then what I do is I'm going to do a protective search. And I mean, it occurs so much in inner city situations that now it's not a thing that violates anyone. I'm doing this so I'm not uneasy, you're not uneasy, then we can get to dialogue. But things have gotten so bad in a lot of the communities that we work in, it's better safe than sorry. I'd rather search you to make sure you don't have a gun because, one, you know I have one. And I don't want a mistake to happen to you, and I don't want to get shot. So we have no problem in doing this.
Do you have officer friends who were shot on the job?
I have friends that have been shot as police officers. I have friends still in Cabrini. I mean, I grew up where I work. And every time I see someone shot, I may not know the individual shot, but when I find out, I knew his mom. I know his dad. I know his big brother. So, I mean, every time someone gets shot in Cabrini or the Abla Homes or Ida B. Wells or Rockwell, where the other two officers that do the Slick Boys program grew up at, anytime someone gets shot there, we know them.
Now, how long ago did you live in Cabrini Green?
I moved out of Cabrini when I was 7 years old.
And what year was that?
That was in 1968.
And a lot of the families who lived there then still live there now?
You know what? Not as many families. What I'm starting to see is this. A lot of the families that got out, because my family moved from Cabrini Green to a neighborhood called Uptown, which is further north in Chicago. And basically what that is a mixed community of blacks, whites, and Hispanics, still economically poor, but thriving to do a little more. The families usually had jobs. And the goal of Cabrini was to get on your feet and get out. My family was in Cabrini because my father was in the military. And my mom wanted to keep our family close and intact. He was out at Great Lakes. My mom came up from North Carolina with the kids, and we lived in Cabrini in hopes of when my father got out of the military, we would all go back down to North Carolina. That never occurred because my father got a job once he left the military. And, you know, 25 years later, we're still here, but we still have our stuff packed. But what happens is that a lot of the people that were following the trend of get on your feet, move out of the housing developments, and start to secure a future, what's happening now is that the young people that were young with me going to school are now moving back into the projects because of the unemployment situation, because of drug addiction, because they had too many children when they were young. And that's shocking to me, that their parents laid everything on the line to get them up out of that, and now that they're bringing their children back to it. And that, to me, is the thing that hurts me the most about what I'm seeing now.
Tell us a little bit more about what makes it so hard now for families in housing projects to get out.
Well, I think the thing that's difficult in the housing projects, no matter if they're in D.C. or what, because we go to all of them, the housing projects in St. Louis, is a lot of young people have lost the American dream. You have to understand, we talk about the Great Depression and that, you know, somewhere up in the 40% to 60% of the population was unemployed. Well, if that's the case, then in a lot of these housing developments, the Great Depression has never ended. Because in Cabrini Green and Robert Taylor and Nickerson Gardens in Los Angeles, I mean, the unemployment rate is still 60% to 70% for a lot of black males between the ages of those ages that you are normally employed. And a lot of young people don't know anyone that works. So now to tell them about school and their future, they look out the window and say, well, look at their future. They went to school. What are they doing? So now they're not being reinforced with anything positive. So we felt we were obligated to go back with our program, tell that we are from the housing projects, tell of the obstacles that we had to step over to become successful, explain to them that it wasn't easy and it's never going to be easy and anything worth having is not easy, but it is attainable.
Eric Davis is my guest. He's part of a trio that's known as the Slick Boys. There are three cops who rap and who also go around to schools and social service programs around the country. If there's such a thing as a typical day for you on the job as a cop, what would that day be like?
Well, a typical day for me is the first call of the day is shots fired. The last call of the day is shots fired. There may not be anyone there shot, but you know it happened. I still see the young kids in the playground playing, hoping that they can just be kids.
Do you work undercover?
Well, we used to work undercover, but when you have videos on Jukebox...
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
I mean, it's funny. We still buy narcotics at times, and lo and behold, there are guys selling us, and they're saying, you guys look like those rappers. And they'll call 10 guys, don't they look like those rappers? And then we give them a little rap like we can't rap. And they're like, it's not you, but you look like those rappers. You need to check out this video by the Slick Boys. And it's amazing. And we usually wait until the later evening to try to buy narcotics because it's impossible during the daytime because the kids literally follow us around and ask for autographs and buttons and T-shirts, and we're trying to sneak up and do police work, and they're sneaking up right behind us.
Is there a kind of police work you can do now that you couldn't do before?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. The police work we do now is basically someone gets shot, the police get there, no one's talking. We may be in New Jersey or Philadelphia, and our beepers are blowing up with Chicago numbers. And we pick up the phone and call, and it's, hey, listen, 21, listen, Fahim, we know who did the killing, and we know who the gun is. Well, tell the police. Nope, we're not telling them. We'll tell you. And what that's done is it's given us ultimate trust. And, I mean, no one trusts the police where I grew up and in a lot of other cities. And now to be able to go in a community, people bring you information and tell you they're doing this here, they're doing that there, where they never would even talk to the police. That's police power.
Are you ever skeptical that some of it is that they want to confess to celebrities? Because America is so celebrity obsessed.
Well, you know, I think in a lot of the communities we work in,
mm-hmm.
The people in these communities are law-abiding people. The vast majority. The small percentage are those that keep the nonsense going. And I think they're so afraid of what's going on in the community that they're actually being held hostage. And they feel, I can't trust the police, because if I tell the police who's doing this and that, the police may tell on me, then my life's in danger. Where they know and they feel, the Slick Boys are going to be here every day, I can trust them, and I know they're going to take care of the problem. And these people in these communities, they don't want drugs sold next door to them. They don't want people shooting out of vacant apartments. They don't want little kids being raped and molested. They want to live in a place that's decent to go out in. So I think they finally feel that these are policemen that truly care about us, that know us, that feel like us. So I think that's why they bring us the information.
My guest is Eric Davis. He's an undercover cop who patrols Chicago's housing projects. He's also one of the Slick Boys, a rap group made up of three undercover cops. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
I live now, die for the green. Here's a description, an inside look at my ghetto dictionary, my manual book. A is for the answers that I cannot find. B is for my
questions. Back with undercover cop Eric Davis. You were in a gang when you were young. How old were you when you joined, and why did you join?
First of all, when I was living in Cabrini, it was a time where things had changed and things were starting to get rougher. I was actually gone from Cabrini when I got shot. I got shot in a place called Uptown. And how you get involved in the gangs then is that the gangs join you.
What do you mean?
And, well, there are certain buildings that you live in. And if you live in that building, the building across the street from you just assumes you're in that organization. And the guys across the street, they're busy shooting at you every day, so you don't have any time to explain, I'm not with this, because you're too busy ducking bullets. So I had to make a decision. I made a decision, am I going to fight the gangs in the buildings across the street and the gangs in my building, or am I going to cut my losses and just say I'm going to fight those guys across the street? Because when I first initially tried to not be involved at all, I got chased by the boys across the street going to school, got chased by them coming home from school, and by the time I made it to my building, I got beat up by the guys in my building. So now it was like, okay, I have to make a decision. And the decision I should have made was join the gang upstairs in my house with my nine sisters and two brothers and my mom and dad. But being a young man, you're influenced by what you see. You were told you're going to be a coward if you tell and this and that. But now things are much, much different. The price you pay may be your life. So I was kind of brought into an organization unknowingly. And then all of a sudden you have friends that die, friends that are shot. Now your anger grows, and before you know it, you're actually out there shooting too. And you don't even know how you got into the thing.
No, did your gang, was your gang involved with selling drugs?
Back when I was out there, that wasn't the scenario. Mm-hmm. They weren't selling drugs. It was more intimidation and extortion. And intimidating, extorting prostitutes, things like that. But it's always been an organized situation. And all they've done is just like organized crime in this country has done, they just progressed to the next level. And the next level is narcotics.
You got shot twice.
Yes.
What happened?
I was in a movie theater, and I disrespected another young man by telling his girlfriend to take her little brother home so I could go out with her. And I knew he was a gang member. He knew I was a gang member. I was being a smart aleck because I was with my buddies, so I had that false courage. Started talking garbage because I thought that's what my buddies wanted to hear, and I thought it would be something cute to say. The young lady went in her purse and handed the young man a handgun. He shot me once in the stomach. I turned to run, shot me in the leg. I laid there and thought I was going to die because I've watched so many movies. I thought when you get shot, that, of course, is what happens. You die. My mom and dad were always good parents, you know, and I must reiterate that point. I made a decision to go out there and do this myself. My mom was and is one of those old Southern women that always stand on you. Do this, boy. Do that, boy. Don't you get in trouble. Stay away from them. Stay off that corner. And I remember the first thing I said once I was laying on the ground. I said, damn, my mother's going to kill me. Because she's a good mom. And I knew if those bullets didn't kill me, her mouth would definitely kill me. So that was the scenario on how I got shot.
How'd you get to the hospital?
I ran home.
You ran home, shot in the leg and shot in the stomach?
And I got up to run because the guy shooting at me was still coming at me and was going to finish me off. And I got up and ran. I ran to my mother and father. They took me to the hospital.
But how did you get away from him when you were wounded like that?
I was running for my life. And I think only people that are shot or have been shot at can relate what that feels like. The adrenaline rush is just tremendous. I thought I was going to die, but I knew if I laid there, he was going to kill me. So I ran. My parents took me to the hospital. While I was in the hospital, the thing that changed me was my mother sitting at the foot of the bed saying, Lord, please, don't let him die. Let me die. And she was crying. And I said, no, Lord, let me die. Please don't let her die. Because there won't be anybody to take care of my brothers and sisters. And right then, I realized I'm already in a gang. And this gang is the gang that really cares about me. My buddies I was with, none of them are here at my bed crying. But my sisters and my mom were there crying. My dad was there crying. And that's when I made the decision that I was going to go and change my life around no matter what. I had to do that for myself. I was going to do it for my family. And my family stood by me. They always respected me. They didn't clamp down on me because this occurred. They still allowed me to go out and do things. And they were supportive of me.
Did any of the members of the gang eventually come and visit you in the hospital?
No. I saw them all on the street. And I explained to them that, you know, I was through with it. And they should have been through with it also, because right now, as it stands, 7 of those guys that I knew are now dead. 7 more of them are in the penitentiary. And in my gang, there are only 15 of us. And that's why I tell people all the time, I thank God for those 2 bullets. So I thank God for those 2 bullets because those bullets were my wake-up call.
When you told the people in your gang that you were finished with it, did they accept that?
Well, they had no choice to accept it. I was
You were the leader.
I didn't realize
that.
They had no choice.
Oh. Well, I always hear that it's really hard to get out of a gang once you're in, and even if you try, they won't let you.
It is, but there are certain bylaws and rules that you go by in these organizations, and one of the bylaws states that if a member wishes to uplift himself by educating himself with knowledge, the organization must support and stand strongly behind that brother so he may prepare himself and the organization for the future. And that's in the bylaws. So I told them that what I was going to do is educate myself. And I didn't tell them that so they'd say, well, we're going to support you for the organization. I did it because I knew they didn't go to school. So that would eliminate a good portion of the day of being with them. Then after school, they would be waiting there, but I'd say, look, I'm going to play basketball, football, baseball, cheerlead, play tennis, tiddlywinks, whatever I got to do because I ain't getting shot anymore. And that's what I did. And that's what I did exactly.
Eric Davis is a tactical police officer with the Chicago Gang Unit. He's also a member of the cop rap group, the Slick Boys. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Eric Davis will be back in the second part of our show.
Trial date is set. You break out in a cold sweat. Hoping and praying. Say, what'd I do to get in this situation? Well, just think back and check out how you really act. First you bang, then you slang. Not police and a judge change everything. 5 to 10 or 2 to 5. It's time to think and it's time to get alive.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with undercover cop Eric Davis. He's a former gang member. He'll tell us more about the shooting that nearly killed him and ultimately led him to walk away from the gang life. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Brothers McMullen. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Eric Davis. He's an undercover cop who patrols the housing projects of Chicago. He's also a member of the rap group The Slick Boys, a trio of undercover cops. Their videos have been shown on MTV and Video Jukebox. In the first part of our conversation, Davis told us that he grew up in one of the projects, and he used to belong to a gang. When he was a teenager, he was shot twice by another gang member in a movie theater. He was hit in the stomach and the leg and thought he was going to die. In the hospital, he decided to change his life. Now, you know who shot you. Did you file charges against them?
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, I still see the young man.
Wow.
And as a matter of fact, I'm his son's godfather.
How did that happen?
I went back to try to get some personal vengeance, and I caught him and the young lady at a party. They were in the back stairwell, kissing. I had a gun. I pulled my gun on them. They knew that I could have killed them then, and all I told them is, look, I'm not with this anymore. And you tell your buddies I'm not with this. And what I'm going to give you as a payment to show you good faith is I'm going to walk away from here. You shot me. I'm not going to shoot you. All I want to do is play ball. All I want to do is leave this gang thing alone. The next time he saw me, he ran up to the street and thanked me for not killing him. He was too nervous to do it then with his girlfriend. And I saw him about 10 years later, and he told me, you know, I got a son, and I've always told him about you. I want you to meet him. And I thought it was kind of strange, and I was still scared. I was like, I ain't going anywhere with you. Last time I had contact with you was the time you shot me, really. And he sat down and explained, and he's now a born-again Christian himself. And he found some things in his life that he needed to rectify that made him into a better person. He has a great son. Proud to say he's a godson of mine. He's a good kid, gets straight A's. He's not involved in the gang. And like I said, the things that occur on these streets are not personal. They're just business.
Okay, so you were shot twice. Mm-hmm. You had this total life-changing experience. Mm-hmm. You left the gang. You ended up being All-American football and basketball in high school.
Right.
You did great in sport. You played, what, 3 cotton balls in college?
Played football, played in the Final Four, played with Phi Slamma Jamma.
Mm-hmm.
Going down to see them tomorrow, going to Texas tomorrow.
Oh, really?
And yeah, I should suit up. I know they need me.
And then you played with the Houston Oilers for a while?
Right. They cut me, and I'm still investigating that. Some kind of conspiracy has to be involved. I see them play. They can't win a game. They need me.
Okay, but then you became a cop. After
right.
absolutely distrusting cops,
right.
after being in a gang, why did you become a cop?
I felt that I could go to work, hang out with my buddies all day, do what I do anyway, get a company car, pay, and carry a gun. You can't beat that. But realistically, what I did is I studied. I saw that I could go back and probably make an immediate impact. I got my college degree, and it was the choice I made. And I try to explain to a lot of young people that are disadvantaged economically, whether they're black, white, Hispanic, Asian, it doesn't matter, that getting your education gives you the opportunity of choice. And that was my choice. I enjoy being outside. I enjoy working with kids. I enjoy doing police work. I enjoy trying to save kids from going up the road I went up, you know, part of the road. They can go down the other part, but part of it they have to stay off of.
You're well known now as a member of the Slick Boys.
Yes.
But before the Slick Boys, when you were a cop, just another cop in the eyes of probably most of the people on the streets where you were patrolling, you understood how little respect the people had for cops. What did you try to do to be different and to earn their respect?
Well, we still had a large reputation. They call me 21, and that's what I keep referring to when I say that. They call me 21. They call the other two partners that I have, Fahim and Eddie Murphy. So those nicknames we got on the street.
How'd you get yours, and what does it mean?
I got mine from playing basketball when I was a kid, and game point was 21. And when you play for money to make the game a little more interesting. And you shoot the ball, and you yell, 21 is game point, and you got to grab your money and run, because guys usually like winning money but never losing money. So, 21 was game point, and I used to win quite a bit. So that's where I got the nickname. So when I came back to Cabrini, everyone there knew me as 21, so they gave the nickname back. And when Fahim and Eddie Murphy got wind of what my nickname was, they put it out on the police department. So now no one even knows my real name. They just call me 21, even the police. And they got theirs because Fahim is one that knows. Randy Holcomb is his real name. He's very compassionate, very understanding, very patient. And Eddie Murphy comes from, he's a comedian. And James Martin is his real name, and he's very funny. He's very witty. He's very street witty, and they love him. They love him to death. So we had reputations before we were the Slick Boys, which I think helped to enhance what we were doing.
There are times when you end up, arresting a kid, and the kid goes to jail. What is prison like for young people now in Chicago, and how have you seen them changed for better or worse when they get out?
Well, I think the penal system in Illinois and all over the country is overcrowded. I mean, there's no doubt. And what we try to do is we stress, and I mean, I have to hit this point, we stress education, not incarceration. But we're not crazy enough to think that there's no need for penitentiaries. I mean, there is going to be a need for penitentiaries because there are going to be those that aren't going to be in that same belief as you. And I think going to the penitentiary and going to jail, for some, it's going to be a rehabilitating experience because they don't want to go back. I don't think you get rehabilitated in jail because I think, one, it's so crowded and there's so many other things occurring there that are criminal that you don't have time to try to turn yourself into something positive in a lot of instances. I hope that we can start to get more young people to not want to experience going to the county jail or going to jail, because for so many young people now, they truly feel that it's a rite to passage.
That it happens to all the guys, and they should experience it too.
Exactly. So I might as well sell cocaine. I might as well carry a pistol because I'm going to jail anyway, or to the cemetery.
And do you see a lot of kids coming back from jail being better criminals than they were before?
I think they're more patient criminals, which makes them a better criminal. I think they're
What does that thinking. Mean, more patient?
I think when they're younger, they're more to react to a situation, to where now they take their time and think. I think they organize themselves because they had nothing but time on their hands, and they're learning from guys that are good criminals. And I feel if they can be educated criminally, why can't the Slick Boys educate positively? And our school system, and our parents, and our social centers, and our government.
My guest is Eric Davis. He's an undercover cop who patrols Chicago's housing projects. He's also one of the Slick Boys, a rap group made up of three undercover cops. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with undercover cop and rapper Eric Davis. Now I want to hear the story of how you first started to rap.
NWA had a song out, which was called F the Police. And every day we came to work, they would put the big speakers out in the projects. And I don't know if the projects in Philly are quite like Chicago, but our buildings are 19-story buildings, which enclose each other. So it's a big echo chamber. And they would play it in these big speakers, and you could hear it all downtown. F the police. And that was like our theme song. and all the kids would die laughing every day they seen us. And they would get there at 5 o'clock, and I'd say, oh, dog, here they go again. And they'd play, and I'd be embarrassed, and Eddie Murphy would be embarrassed. But, you know, we took it in good spirits. So we went and met the kids on Cambridge Street, and we explained to them, we said, you know, NWA's getting paid. We're getting paid. Guess who's not getting paid in this formula? And they said, you're just jealous. No, I'm not getting jealous. I'm getting paid. You can't rap. I said, we can rap. I said, if they can rap, if that's a song, I can make up a song in an hour. You can't make a song. And Eddie Murphy goes, we can make up as many songs as we want to. It's easy to rap. And mind you, we had never rapped in our lives. We had listened to rap music, but we had never rapped in our lives. So they said, well, you know what? Meet us back here in a week, and we'll have some songs about you guys, and you guys have some songs. So we came back in a week. We had 3 songs. They had a half a song done. We started rapping, and the kids fell out. They loved it. They said, this is great. You guys been rapping. You're really rappers. I said, no, we're the police. You see us every day. That's why you played that song for us. And then that takes us to all the kids coming by the station, and it takes us to where we are now, and it's very exciting, and we're thankful that we even have the opportunity to touch as many young lives as we've had.
So what's the first rap that you did?
Actually, the first rap that we had was a rap that was basically what we call in the black neighborhood signifying. And what that rap was about was all those kids that used to play that song about us, and we talked about how they need to take baths and cut their hair, and all the kids loved that because now we did digs back on them.
Could you do a few lines?
No, it was dirty.
Oh. Anything you could do?
No, it was just like the songs they listened to. It was just like the songs they listened to. And then the next song we did was a song called Slick Boys. And the next song we did is What You Gonna Do.
How about then, a few lines of Slick Boys?
Okay. Our days begin when your days end. We're the Slick Boys on the set and we're standing on it. We work in a place called Cabrini Green. It sounds so pretty, but the brothers are mean. I'm 21, that's Fahim and Murphy. We're on a mission to give thugs no mercy. Walking down the street, boy, what do you see? You see the dope man doing the dope man thing. He's serving up bags of variety of death and destruction in our community. We need the Slick Boys.
Great. Now, did you have any idea you had a talent for rap?
No.
So were you really surprised?
You know what? The young people had backed us into a corner that it was like, I have to learn how to rap. So it was just getting a chair and sitting in front of the mirror and doing it over and over because we knew if we came weak that they were going to chastise us. So we practiced and we practiced and we practiced. And then, of course, once we began to rap, they helped us and they still continue to coach us and help us. So we're like their rap group, no matter, because now we're in Robert Taylor working.
The projects.
And that's where we're in the Robert Taylor housing projects. And, you know, it's like a phone line that's all connected in all the projects. And it's like, oh, the Slick Boys are down there. So we're truly the housing projects in the city. We're truly their rap group. We're of them, we're from them, we're with them, we love them.
It sounds like rapping for you started off as an impersonation and ended up being something that you genuinely do.
No doubt. It's a true vocation. And now what's happening is that we go out and see young people, or I try to go to the grocery store, which is very difficult now, and people say, hey, that's that rapper. Mom, that's that rapper. Can I get his autograph? And I tell their moms, no, I'm a police officer. Because as soon as they hear rapper, of course, parents frown up. And I say, well, I'm a police officer. And then the kids say, well, yeah, he's a police officer too. So now to them, a police officer is very secondary. You know, they're very excited about the rap part.
So you work in plain clothes. What do you wear on the job?
Did you see the video?
Yeah.
Same stuff.
Well, describe it for our listeners who haven't seen it.
If it's 80 degrees, no shirt, baseball hat, combat boots, sunglasses, You know, I mean, we're the guys that even in our police car, people lock their doors on us. We're the guys that when we come to scenes, we went to a holdup at a place called the Gap, which is a jean outlet here in Chicago. We go, we get there first. The lady's still on the phone with the police. We're on the radio with the squad. She's saying, there are three black guys with guns out here. And we're saying, squad, it's us. We're the police. She's saying, they're telling her, lady, they're the police. Let them in. She's saying, no way. You better send somebody in a uniform. So, you know, I understand that. But a lot of that is negative media perception that's portrayed. So I think it's important for us to continue going out the way we do because we want young people in the communities to realize that you can wear baseball hats, sunglasses, baggy jeans and combat boots and be a police officer, a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant. And we also want people in mid-America to know that every black guy with a starter jacket and a baseball hat isn't going to carjack you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Eric Davis is a tactical police officer with the Chicago Gang Unit. He's also a member of the cop rap group The Slick Boys. They have a CD expected out in October. Our interview was recorded last February. Well, that concludes our series on young people and the epidemic of violence. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have about Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports on the continuing NATO offensive against the Bosnian Serbs. Andy Bowers will join us from Sarajevo to report on what's going on in that city. And Silvia Pajoli has the diplomatic news tonight from Belgrade, Serbia. Also, Mary Kay Magstad reports on domestic violence in Cambodia. Linda Wertheimer talks with Mary Carr. She's the author of the novel The Liars Club about growing up in Texas. And I'll talk with Nicholas Evans, a British screenwriter who's written a first novel. The book rights went for $3 million. The movie rights for another $3 million. The book is about a young girl and her mother and an injured horse.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's news when a young actor, writer, director gets a feature made for $16,000. It's even bigger news when, after being rejected by almost every film festival and distribution company you can think of, that feature finally gets admitted to the Sundance Film Festival and wins the grand prize. It's news, but does that make it a good movie? Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Brothers McMullen.
You have to hand it to Edward Burns. He's 27 years old. His previous job experience was mainly as a production assistant at Entertainment Tonight, and now he's the toast of the independent film community. Unfortunately, his life story turns out to be a lot more interesting than his movie. Watching The Brothers McMullen is a little like going home for dinner and being fed your mom's tuna noodle casserole. It's not really good, but it sure feels homemade. The Brothers McMullen was shot on grainy 16mm film, mostly at Burns' parents' house. And according to Burns, only one of the actors is a professional, by which we mean he had a role in Porky's. The movie is a coming-of-age story. It's about what happens to three Irish Catholic brothers when their mother returns to Ireland and the two younger boys move in with their married big brother. The eldest, Jack, is just beginning to have marital troubles. The middle brother, Barry, takes up with an aspiring actress to whom he can't commit. And the youngest, Patrick, wrestles with his conscience over how love squares with his devout Catholicism. The youngest, in fact, is the most diverting of the three. Patrick is the only one whose story is genuinely absorbing, and the only one who's played by a genuinely interesting actor, Mike McGlone, who seems to have gotten all his moves from Matt Dillon, but whose pudgy, funny face comes straight from County Cork. Here is McGlone stewing about love and life with his cynical brother, Barry, played by Edward Burns himself.
You don't believe in true love? You don't believe God has someone out there just for you? And he allows a lucky few to be fortunate enough to find one another?
How the hell did a fruitcake like you end up as my brother? No, I do not believe in true love. Okay, but if there is such a thing as true love, I'm sure God has nothing to do with it.
You're just afraid. You're just afraid to fall in love, Barry. I've always been afraid of the emotions.
Listen, lover boy, all right? We're not on Oprah talking about me and my emotions, all right?
Far be it from me to criticize a screenplay for being talky, But the talk has to be worth listening to, and mostly the gabfest that goes on in The Brothers McMullen isn't. The best scene is one involving Barry's theory about men and women and bananas. It really is a gem. But Barry himself is generally so callow and dislikable that the movie goes sour every time he's on screen. And the older brother, played by that guy from Porky's, Jack Mulcahy, is a lump. The movie stops in its tracks whenever it bumps into him. Still, the men are models of Dostoevskian complexity compared with the women. One's a long-suffering saint, one's a sex-hungry spider-woman, and one is Burns's primitive idea of a free spirit, which is to say, someone who frizzes her hair and works on cars and talks like Madonna. The Brothers McMullen isn't an unpleasant movie, but I do think most of the people raving about it are giving it too many extra points for being independent, cheaply made, and frequently rejected, an underdog. To put matters in perspective, it might help to remember another young independent filmmaker, this one back in the early 70s. He scraped together enough money to finance a grainy personal feature about Catholics coming of age, using unknown actors in whatever locations he could get away with. The movie's name was Mean Streets, and the young filmmaker was Martin Scorsese. Ed Burns might go on to make a film like that, but to tell you the truth, I'd be less surprised if he went on to make something like Porky's.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Dorothy Farabee, with Nancy Updike and Alan Tu, who directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language. Language instruction at home or on the go with Living Language. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Despite new overtures toward peace by Serbia, NATO is continuing its air raids against Bosnian Serb positions. The Secretary General of the UN, among others, has called on the Bosnian Serbs to withdraw heavy weaponry from around Sarajevo and other safe havens and to stop attacking civilians. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says he will continue to support NATO actions until the Bosnian Serbs comply. French President Jacques Chirac has offered to extend France's so-called nuclear umbrella to the European Union. The proposal comes one day before France is to begin its controversial nuclear bomb tests in the South Pacific. Joe Schumann reports.
French defense officials are refusing to say when the first of 7 or 8 nuclear explosions in French Polynesia will take place, though the defense minister has said it could be Friday. President Chirac's offer on the eve of the test to share with France's European partners the updated nuclear arsenal is part of an effort to deflect criticism of his decision to restart testing in the first place. 7 European countries have joined most nations from the South Pacific in objecting to the tests. Paris has become the daily scene of protests and declarations against them. 1,300 French scientists called for a test ban earlier this week, and the environmental group Greenpeace plans to deliver a protest petition with more than 3 million signatures to Chirac on Friday. Chirac said his suggestion that the test results be shared with the European Union would only enhance the continent's security. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Schumann in Paris.
The Secretary of Labor has given a pre-Labor Day speech. Secretary Robert Reich discussed the state of the American workforce today. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich says Labor Day 1995 finds American workers losing ground. The overall economy is growing, he says, and profits are up, but paychecks for most American workers are not.
The steady decline of the median wage in this country and the widening gap between the people at the top and the rest of us threatens the stability and the prosperity of this nation.
Reich criticizes proposals from the Republican-controlled Congress, which he says benefit business and the wealthy, and he urges support for President Clinton's economic proposals. Bill Small, Washington.
The government says Americans' personal income rose 0.7% in July, the biggest gain in half a year. The government also says consumer spending rose just 0.2%. Analysts suggest consumers were cautious even while they were making more money. Some also believe much of the slow spending was on discounted goods because stores are trying to get rid of inventory that's beginning to pile up on shelves. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 11 points at 4,615. Trading is active. The Nasdaq is up 6 points at 1,018. This is NPR. Starting tomorrow, supporters of capital punishment can count New York among the 38 states prepared to execute convicted murderers. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchliff reports.
With families of murder victims at his side, Governor George Pataki heralded the beginning of a new era in New York.
When young prosecutors are trained, they learn an awful lot about the law. But what they're finally taught is when they go out in court to be ready to say, the people are ready. Midnight tonight, the death penalty takes effect. The people are ready and justice will be served.
The last execution in New York was by electric chair in 1963. The law was declared unconstitutional 10 years later. The new measure calls for death by lethal injection. Death penalty opponents plan demonstrations around the state as the midnight deadline approaches. Officials expect the first death penalty case will be prosecuted soon, but defense appeals could delay the first execution under the new law into the next century. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliff in New York.
A federal judge has struck down the nation's 148-year-old foreign extradition law. U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth says it violates the Constitution by allowing the executive branch to review legal decisions from the judiciary. The ruling now prevents the extradition of two Chicago men sought by Canada on kidnapping charges, but the judge also says the ruling will protect others awaiting international extradition. The Boston Herald is reporting the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine says his magazine has increased its security. That's because Randall Terry, the founder of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue, sent a fax to the journal regarding its report on new abortion drugs. The editor says Terry's message was, quote, nasty. Researchers found abortion can be induced by a woman at home with a combination of two drugs already on the marketplace. Terry wrote, when abortion is illegal, the researcher will be hunted down. This is NPR.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman.
Bosnian Prime Minister Haris Salajic says the extensive NATO airstrikes against Bosnian Serb positions have made peace more possible. We have more from NPR's Dieter Berger in Bonn.
The Bosnian Prime Minister said the air raids have restored his faith in human society. After meeting with German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel, Haris Salajic said the NATO strikes against Bosnian Serb positions make peace in the region more likely. He told reporters he believes the Serbian government will now realize its monopoly on force is gone. The Bosnian leader expressed hope Belgrade will now exert enough pressure on the Bosnian Serbs to bring them to the negotiating table. German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel said the five-nation contact group that is working on peace negotiations for Bosnia will meet in Germany this weekend. In Bonn, a five-day international conference to document human rights abuses in Bosnia has opened. I'm Dieter Berger in Bonn.
The Justice Department says it will review a request to investigate alleged incidents described by former L.A. Detective Mark Furman, which were played at the O.J. Simpson murder trial.
The Los Angeles branch of the NAACP sent a letter to Attorney General Janet Reno requesting the review. The civil rights group wants her agency to launch an independent probe into the alleged incidents that Furman describes. The group says it's most concerned about Furman's claims that blacks have been singled out for arrest without sufficient cause and his boasts of police who tamper with evidence in criminal cases. Meanwhile, Furman's civil attorney has quit. Lawyer Robert Turtolo has issued a statement saying he is no longer representing Mark Furman. He says the reasons are personal but obvious. Turtolo says he's disgusted with the racist comments Furman made on tape for a screenwriter. Another of President Clinton's former business partners has pleaded guilty in the Whitewater land development case. Defendant Susan McDougal says she is ready for her trial. UPI's Ken Miller reports.
Mrs. McDougal pleaded innocent to 8 Whitewater-related charges, including fraud and conspiracy. Her attorney says he needs some time to prepare for a trial, but Mrs. McDougal is ready to get started.
I would seriously like to talk to the judge and say, listen to my story, listen to their story, and let's all go home. Because I think that would be the case.
Her trial is set to begin October 10th, the same date her ex-husband Jim McDougal and Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker are to go on trial. All 3 are named in a 21-count indictment. Ken Miller, Little Rock, Arkansas.
A federal judge has struck down the nation's foreign extradition law after 148 years on the books. The judge says it violates the Constitution by allowing the executive branch to review judicial decisions. On Wall Street, stocks moved up today. The Dow gained 6 points to close at 4,610. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 and moderate trading of 302 million shares. This is NPR News. The chief minister of India's northwestern Punjab state has been killed in a massive car bomb explosion. Scott Newman reports from New Delhi.
The scene in the Punjab capital, Chandigarh, was chaotic following the bomb blast that killed the state's chief minister, Beyant Singh, as he was stepping into his bulletproof car. Besides Singh, at least 12 others, most of them the chief minister's personal bodyguards, were killed in the explosion. There were so many body parts and debris spread across the blast site that authorities said they were having difficulty identifying the human remains. Authorities believe the bomb was planted in a state-owned car parked next to the chief minister's vehicle. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but police suspect Sikh militants, part of a separatist movement the Indian government says was all but eliminated 3 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Newman in New Delhi.
Parts of South Dakota's 1993 abortion law have been declared unconstitutional by a federal judge. He says the state cannot enforce the provision requiring parents be told before a minor gets an abortion. The judge says the law doesn't meet the test because it does not allow a minor girl to go to a judge to prove she is mature enough to decide for herself or that an abortion would be in her best interest. Civil and criminal penalties for doctors who fail to comply with the law or have also been ruled unconstitutional. Florida officials say it could take a month before 1,000 flood victims can go home in southwestern Florida. The floods were triggered by Tropical Storm Jerry, which poured heavy rain on the region last week. Floodwaters have been rising as they flow to the coast. NASA has delayed the launch of the Space Shuttle Endeavour by about a week. The launch was scrubbed early this morning because of an overheated fuel cell. A spokesman says engineers believe a temperature-regulating valve on the fuel cell may have gotten stuck. Technicians will replace the entire fuel cell, which is expected to delay the takeoff a week. Up until the fuel cell was troubled, NASA officials were actually worried about thunderstorms. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.